This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It's Friday. Shabbat shalom, TGIF. What is it in Arabic? Something Mubarak? I've forgotten. I'm going to have to write that down. Anyhow, welcome to our Friday show. And Senator Bernie Sanders with us in our first hour, as always. By the way, in our second hour, we're going to get P.J. Crowley on to talk about what's going on in Kosovo and Serbia. I have a pretty strong inkling of it. I've spent a little bit of time around that part of the world, but he's the real expert. We're going to find out. And then it's Anything Goes Friday. We'll be taking your calls throughout the day on any topic you want to talk about. But first, our first hour, United States Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont, neither a Democrat nor a Republican, but an independent. His website, sanders.senate.gov. And for 5 years now, he's been a regular every Friday on this show, taking your calls at 866-303-2270. Bernie, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom, and I do not know Arabic either. So
okay. Well, welcome to the show. And you're on the budget committee, and there's a lot going on there.
There is, Tom. And I know that when you talk about budget, it seems kind of boring to people, you know, a billion here and a billion there. But the reality is that how we do our budget in many ways determines what happens in the United States of America, what our priorities are, where we invest. And I'll tell you what my priorities will be as a member of that budget committee. Number one, I want to make sure that we have the resources available to start addressing the enormous and serious economic problems facing working families and the middle class. I don't have to tell any of the listeners that we have millions and millions of people struggling hard just to keep their heads above water. People can't afford to pay their heating bills. Price of gas is $3.15 a gallon. Food costs are going up. Cost of college education is very high, et cetera, et cetera. So what we have got to do is create a budget which begins to focus on the needs of the middle class working families. And to do that, there are several very important areas that we have got to work on. And they're going to be very controversial. First thought, we have to make a choice as a committee and as a nation as to whether or not we continue to provide hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks for the wealthiest 1%, the people who have not had it so good in American society for the last 60 or so years. And you have a situation today where the top one-tenth of 1% earns more income than the bottom 50%. We have the greatest gap between the rich and everybody else than any modern, any industrialized country in the world has. So I think we have to take a hard look at that and say, sorry, making sure that our kids have a decent education, reversing global warming, investing in our infrastructure is far more important than giving huge tax breaks for the very, very wealthy. That's going to be a very important fight. It's going to be a tough one, because certainly you'll have the president, opposing any legislation that takes away tax breaks from his wealthy friends or his corporate buddies. But that's an area that we've got to work on. The second area is one that has gotten very little attention, Tom, but I think we have got to take a hard look at as well. And that is not just the war in Iraq and the fact that we spend over $12 billion every single month in the war in Iraq. That's bad enough. We're not paying for that. Mm-hmm. That's simply being passed on to our kids and our grandchildren, adding up to...
With interest.
Yeah, that, and interest, right. So that's part of the $9 trillion national debt that we have. The other area that we have to take a look at is the defense budget in general, above and beyond the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. And that we're spending now, the president has proposed, if my memory is correct, about $515 billion a year for the Pentagon. Add to that another $30 billion or so for nuclear weapons, which is not part of the doesn't come out of the defense budget. And you're looking at over $540 billion, which is well over half of the discretionary spending that we do as a nation. And if you compare that to what we spend in education, if you compare that to what we spend on environmental needs or on taking care of nutrition programs in this country, the Defense Department in every instance dwarfs what we're spending in social needs. And I think we have to ask ourselves, where is that money going? All of us are concerned about international terrorism. Do we think that all $515 billion of that money is going to fight terrorism? No, it's not. Obviously, it's not. Nuclear weapons are not being used to fight terrorism. Aircraft carriers and various types of new weapon systems are not
Star Wars
are not being used to fight terrorism. Then who are they being used to fight? Who's the enemy? And then if the enemy, if somebody says, well, we're worried about China, for example, which does have a growing military, then the question immediately becomes, so why do we have a trade agreement with China, which allows American companies not only to throw American workers out on the street and move to China, but to transfer an enormous amount of dual-use technology, which is helping to make China a very technologically advanced country, and much of that technology can be used for the military.
Not only that, if I may interrupt,
sure.
Last week China raised to 10% added a 10% tariff on top of the import tariffs that they already have for any vehicles made in the United States that have, quote, advanced technology, end quote, in them. Things like the screens that give you directions around, you know, those kind of things, navigation systems and whatnot. Any kind of fancy stuff. In other words, any high-end cars made in the United States, they're going to charge extra to import into China because they want to protect their domestic industry.
Well, but my point is here, above and beyond China's discriminatory trade practices, if we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars to defend ourselves against China, why are we giving them technology to begin with?
Right.
Which is what we're doing. And the second area is, why are they allowed to, and you've made this point many times, buy up industries in the United States, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my point here is not to be anti-China, but to take a look at the defense budget and say, yes, we must have a strong, strong military. Yes, we must do everything we can do. Must do everything we can to protect the American people from terrorism. But where is all of this $515 billion going? You know what I'm reminded of, Tom, and you remember this well, reading about it, is Dwight David Eisenhower when he left office in 1960. And remember the speech that he gave, famous speech about the military-industrial complex?
Yeah.
And what he said is that these people are so powerful that they can force the government to spend more than we need to spend, which is taking away money from the poor, from the children, from those in need. And I think that what Eisenhower said way back then is really true today. So the defense budget is an area I think we must take a look at, in addition to the enormous tax breaks we're giving to people who don't need it. And then what we have to say is, okay, what does sensible investment mean? Where should we be investing? Well, I just had a meeting in my state capital yesterday with people on the Vermont State Legislature Transportation Committee. And they're telling me what I'm sure states all over this country are saying, is that our infrastructure is in very, very serious problems. That was manifested in the collapse of the bridge in Minneapolis, but it exists in probably 49 other states. And we have to invest in our infrastructure. We certainly have to invest in reversing global warming, which means a lot of jobs can be created as we expand the solar industry, as we expand wind, geothermal, biomass. A lot of good things can happen as we break our dependence on oil and coal. God only knows that with 47 million Americans without any health insurance, we have to take a hard look at our health care system. Point being, right now, I think the Budget Committee, the United States Senate, the United States Congress, the American people have to take a very hard look at where we're spending, and I think the end result will be we are spending, in many instances, a lot of money where we don't need to spend. And then we have to take a look at where we're not spending. And I think the corollary there is that we're not spending enough in areas that we should be spending. And that's kind of an exercise that I would hope that the Budget Committee begins soon.
Yeah. Would you like to hear a 1 minute, 10 second clip of Eisenhower saying?
I would.
Yeah, here it is. This is incredible.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is 2 electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is 2 fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
It's his famous cross of iron speech.
And, wow. That is, now, you know, I hadn't heard that for a very long time. That's very moving. And remember, this is a Republican.
Yeah.
Republican president who certainly knew something about the military. He was a four-star general and led the Allied forces in Europe.
Yeah.
That is an extraordinary speech. And I think...
And he gave that as president of the United States. That was April 16th, 1953.
Yeah.
When he gave that speech to the American Society of Newspaper Editors.
That was 1953?
That's right.
Huh, I thought it was later than that.
Yeah, no, his military-industrial complex speech came in 1960 when he
left
office.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
But
right.
this was early on where he was arguing against these huge military appropriations. It's just incredible. Just incredible.
Well, we've got a lot to learn from that Republican president.
We do. He was a good man. We have Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Brunch with Bernie, 866-303-2270. Bernie will be taking your calls right now.
Talk radio for the rest of us. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Hang on tight, the road may get bumping. Dig your nails in and swallow your pride. I hope we're headed in the right direction.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
22 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website. Great newsletter there. Always a lot of great information. And, Bernie, shall we pick up some phone calls
here? Well, we
should,
but I'll tell you, Tom, I think what we're going to put on this website is some of the quotes of that Republican president, Dwight David Eisenhower.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like to hear some Democrats talking the same language that Eisenhower did 40 years ago.
I agree. And have your chief of staff drop me an email, and I'll just send him the clips that I've got, because I've got a great collection of Eisenhower
clips. I mean,
that
is really incredible, especially from a guy, of course, who was a war hero and a four-star general.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. The guys who've seen the blood and death and carnage of war firsthand tend to be the ones who are not all that gung-ho about right. being armchair generals like George Bush.
Right.
All right,
let's do it.
All righty, let's do it. Dave in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, and if I may suggest, I'll plug a film, Why We Fight, that starts off with that speech. It's a marvelous documentary. Anyways, I was so pleased to hear Mr. Sanders, Senator Sanders, praise this and frame it into national defense. You know, if we go after the defense budget, you know what's going to be thrown back in our face about the week on defense.
Right.
But we have other issues. I was talking to a friend who works for a national telecom carrier. The network control centers for that carrier are now out of country in Argentina, Philippines. That's a national defense issue. Mm-hmm. We've given them the keys to our networks. We've given manufacturing away. That's national defense. We need these infrastructures for a strong national defense, and it needs to be framed in that context.
Well, Dave, I think you're absolutely right. You know, what is, and this is an issue that resonates with many conservatives as well. It's one thing to talk about our disastrous trade policies in terms of the loss of millions of good-paying jobs, but then when you find people concerned about our national security saying, hey, what's going on in America? Because we can't even manufacture the weaponry or the spare parts that our military needs, we have to import that stuff from abroad, then these guys begin to say, we've got a problem. And I just myself have never understood how anyone could think we can remain a strong and great country if we are not producing the type of goods that we need. And I think any American who just goes to any department store and buys almost any product increasingly sees that product is being made in another country. And this whole issue of trade, demanding that corporate America reinvest in the United States of America, create decent paying jobs here, create a manufacturing infrastructure for engineering, other types of jobs. To me, this is a major, major issue. And I would like to hear, the candidates talking about this, very much.
Amen. Maurice in Atlanta, Georgia. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Good.
Well, I wanted to ask a question, and I've asked you this before, but I wanted to get another indemnification of it. Senator Sanders, how committed are you towards public financing of campaigns? And in the next congressional cycle, will you craft a bill that will move that issue forward? And as a suggestion, I suggest that you do as Barack Obama is intimating he will do on health care, in having public hearings on the issue to pull the people out who would be against said issue.
Maurice, I consider the issue of public funding of elections to be enormously important. And whether it's a bill that I bring forth or some other senator brings forth is not important. I will work in every way that I can to make this happen. Because unless we get a handle on money in politics and the very clear fact that the reason that government works so hard for the wealthy and the powerful has a lot to do with where presidents and members of Congress get their money from. Unless we get a handle on that, we are not going to change the priorities of this country. It is not an accident that it took us 9 years to raise the minimum wage above an abysmal $5.15 an hour. Couldn't do that. But our Republican friends were busy giving hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires. A moment ago, Tom, we just talked about our disastrous trade policies. I can remember it was just a couple of years ago where corporate America was saying, literally saying publicly, that if people don't vote for those trade policies, they're not going to get campaign contributions.
Wow. Wow. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, sanders.senate.gov, his website, ours, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop by. Drop into our live chat room, airamerica.com for the blog, 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And how this will last. I steady my gaze at their brainwaves over their heads. During a long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Together we must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. It's our Bernie Sanders and Dwight Eisenhower. You got me started, Bernie. I just like playing these clips.
You know, Tom, I think that's a good thing to do. I think some of what the issues that Eisenhower raised in terms of what it means to be spending money on tanks and guns and bombs rather than the needs of our children and elderly is a lesson that is probably more relevant today than it was during the 1950s. And the power of the military-industrial complex, the revolving door that exists between the Pentagon and government and these private large contractors is huge. And it's an issue that we just don't talk enough about.
Yeah, well said. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Dory in L.A. Hey, Dory, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, thank you very much. And I wanted to ask the Senator, because I know that you're a member of the Veterans Affairs Committee.
Yes, I am.
And why Senate Bill S-961 has not been allowed to go to the floor of the Senate, and which, as you know, it would finally grant and acknowledge veteran status to the merchant marines who served during World War II and allow them to finally receive benefits of only $1,000 a month for the rest of their life. And my father was a merchant mariner. He was one of the few first tankers to go into Normandy. He was at the Battle of Iwo Jima and at Okinawa and has never been granted veteran status. So I would just like to know what's going to happen with this, if anything.
Okay, Dory, thanks for the question. And I, to be honest, I can't give you a detailed, informative answer, but it is something that I will look up. But this is what I will say, Dory, as a member of the Veterans Committee. Year after year after year, some of us have been struggling with the Bush administration to make sure that we begin to provide the health care and other benefits that our veterans were promised and deserve. And we've had opposition from the Bush administration year after year after year. What I'm very happy to say is that last year, working with the veterans organizations, we passed by far the largest veterans budget in the history of the VA, which is going to provide billions of dollars more, not only for those soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, but to take care of the waiting lines that exist for soldiers from World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, etc. So we are making some progress in terms of providing for our veterans, but we have still a very long way to go, and I will take a look at S-961.
Good. Thank you. Beth in Minneapolis, Minnesota, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Senator Sanders, I wanted to talk about something that, to me, has been floating under the radar. It's deja vu all over again, and that is the disturbing trend of some of our representatives in Washington to talk about building more nuclear power plants. And they cite the smaller, more efficient power plants in Europe as being the example. And yet, if you look at what's happening because of drought, they're having to shut down over 20 power plants in the southeast. And in Europe, these power plants are heating the waterways to the point where they are becoming unusable. But Joe Biden, Al Gore, and others, and even some of our candidates running for office, are supporting these power plants. And, you know, I remember how Dr. Helen Caldicott in the 70s and 80s was an educator. She stopped her medical practice to be a worldwide educator.
She still is, Beth. She's been on this program twice in the last year.
Oh, gosh, Tom, I missed that. I'm sorry. Well, she says that nuclear power is not the answer to global warming, right. And she has a book to that effect. Can you please talk about
it? Sure. Well, Beth, you are right that certainly in the Congress there has been a resurgence of discussion about nuclear power. In fact, many of these people are referring to it as a nuclear renaissance. That's the word that they use. And their argument is, look, we're concerned about global warming, you're concerned about greenhouse gas emissions, then the answer is nuclear power. We've got to build dozens and dozens of new plants around the country. I strongly disagree with that. Although I must tell you, as a member of the Energy Committee and the Environmental Committee, my position is in a minority perspective. The reason that I'm opposed to that line of thought is, for a start, we don't know how to get rid of nuclear waste. And I just don't know how you continue building plants which generate more and more waste, which will be with us for millions and millions of years, if you don't know how to get rid of it. Number two, building new nuclear power plants is extremely expensive. Number three, generating this type of nuclear waste and so forth becomes and nuclear power plants becomes a target for terrorists. Now, my view is that we can be very, very effective if we move toward solar, if we move toward wind, if we do what many of the European countries are doing. There will now be, as I understand it, within a couple of years, for example, there will be a solar thermal plant. That's a different type of technology being built in the Mojave Desert, which will be as large as a small nuclear power plant. The cost of building that plant is pretty, relatively speaking, inexpensive. The cost of the electricity will be quite inexpensive compared to other types of technologies. There is a potential just in the southwest of this country, in California, Nevada, elsewhere, to be building dozens of these plants, which can end up producing up to one-third of the electricity that we as a nation need. So if I'm looking at all of the problems associated with nuclear energy and how you get rid of that waste and all the other associated problems, or building solar thermal plants, to me it's a no-brainer that you go with solar thermal, not to mention wind, not to mention geothermal, not to mention biomass. So I would, not to mention energy efficiency. So I would look at sustainable energy and energy efficiency a lot quicker than I would nuclear power.
Amen. John in Gary, Indiana, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hi, John.
I'd like to ask if anybody is taking Sabell Edmund accusations seriously in the State Department or anywhere.
Well, why don't you tell me a little bit about that?
Oh, I'm sorry, I just dropped John.
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. We'll talk about that in a future show because I don't have the details right in front of me right now. Michael in Seattle, Washington. Michael, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm appreciating hearing the speeches by the clips from Dwight Eisenhower. He was my first president. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. And I was wondering if you might also be able to play for Mr. Sanders the quote by Kennedy from the time that he spoke at a university on the East Coast. I forget what it was, which university it was, where he was talking about how we are not interested in the Pax Americana.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard that one?
I think you're talking about a speech at Michigan State University. I've played it on the show a few times. But,
oh, really? I haven't heard you do that.
Yeah, we're not going to do old clips day today.
Okay. Well, that's the only thing that I had to say.
Okay.
Well, thanks, Michael. I think, especially when you hear from a great military leader like Eisenhower, talking about the impact of excessive military spending on the weakest, the most vulnerable people in a society, on health care and so forth, it really resonates. And when you hear him also talking about the power of the military-industrial complex, I mean, I think the vast majority of the people, certainly including me, want to make sure that we have a strong defense. We have to do that. And want to make sure that we are fighting international terrorism, which is a very serious issue, in the best possible way that we can. But having said that, that does not necessarily mean that you have to spend $515 billion a year on the defense, more than half of our discretionary funding. And as one of the earlier callers point out, there's a whole lot about defense that we should be looking at that the defense budget does not. For example, to the degree that we remain dependent on Mideast oil, that's a defense issue. Having to prop up and work with authoritarian governments in the Middle East is a defense issue. Getting involved in the war in Iraq is a defense issue. If, for example, we could use some of our defense spending to build sustainable energy here in the United States, you know what? That makes us a lot safer country. If we could reach out to poor people all over the world and help them cure diseases which are curable, educate their children, deal with their problems, win them over to the United States of America rather than Osama bin Laden, that's a defense issue, which might not only improve the lives for millions and millions of people, but also win us a lot of friends that we don't have right now.
Barack Obama made that point last night in the debates, and it shocked me, the statistic. He said our total foreign aid to Central and South America is $2 billion a year, which is the amount of money we spend in Iraq in 3 days.
That's right. And I think I've mentioned, I mean, sometimes some of the programs that we have with AID and so forth, Peace Corps, other groups, do tremendous amounts of good for pennies.
Mm-hmm.
Pennies.
Yeah, and instead we've got Castro flooding Central and South America with doctors.
That's right.
I mean, how can you compete? I mean, it's just common sense. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. He's taking your calls at 866-303-2270. His website, sanders.senate.gov. Ours, tomhartman.com and airamerica.com. 45 minutes past the hour. Stick around. We'll be right back. Here's your opportunity to support your local station. Listen for the ads.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I fell into a burning roof fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 ring of fire.
As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government, must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow.
There you go. 9:50, Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program, our Brunch with Bernie segment.
Tom, I think we've concluded we want Eisenhower for president. Right?
There you go. I like Ike.
Bring him back.
I like Ike. Oh, my. Well, you know what's so funny is the Democrats, you know, I think by and large have often talked like that and certainly have been talking like that for the last two decades. And Republicans seem to have completely forgotten Eisenhower. They all worship Reagan with his deficit spending and
no, that's
know,
exactly right.
His corruption.
And the moderate type of politics of an Eisenhower has been just completely driven from the Republican Party.
Yeah, and tragically, it swept so many along. My dad was an Eisenhower Republican, but he just kind of followed along with Bush as he got older. And, you know, it's just, anyway. Bob in Amherst, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. Thanks for calling, Bob.
Hey, Tom and Bernie, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I spent a lot of time up in Vermont. I went to Brattleboro, involved in the art scene up there, and which leads to my my query. I'm an artist. I'm retired, living on Social Security, fixed income. Why, after I've worked 40 years, being a teacher, home health aide, volunteer, carpenter, many, many things, I have to live below the poverty level? Shouldn't the baseline for Social Security be the poverty level? And shouldn't there be more work programs like Title V, senior employment programs for people over in the retirement age who want to work? That seems to have dried up.
Well, that's Bob, thanks for your question, and you touch on a number of very important issues. Number one issue is that for millions of seniors, they're just not making it on Social Security. The amount of money they receive is not enough to allow them to pay for their basic needs. One of the areas that we have worked on over the years, and we are going to come back to, is to look at how we determine what the cost of living is for seniors. Right now, cost of living for all government employees is pretty much coming out of one pot. But for seniors, in many ways, it is higher because they're more dependent on health care costs, drugs, and so forth and so on. And that would be one mechanism to get more money back to seniors. And second of all, as Bob indicates, a lot of seniors who would love to work, who would love to contribute to our society, to mentor younger people, and we should provide those opportunities as well. There's just an enormous amount of talent out there.
Yeah, indeed. Aaron in Seattle, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders and Tom. I want to thank both of you for all that you do. I have a question, and just if you could bear with me for just a moment. I'm a retired military officer, and I have a very strong concern about what we're talking about today with the military-industrial government complex and this confluence of the manipulation of the American population with fear, always fearing something. There's always got to be some enemy.
If I may interrupt, Aaron, it's become the military-industrial media complex now.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, many people, many Americans do not know what is being done in their name. You know, when we have gone into countries, invaded other countries, done regime change because of supposedly American interests, which are really corporate interests, and American soldiers and sailors and airmen are dying because of these corporate interests, and it just, many Americans are not aware of what's going on globally.
So, Aaron, your question.
Under the name of America.
Well, Aaron, you said it better than
what can we do? What can American citizens do to stop this?
Well, you said it better than I have, and better than I can. You're absolutely right. The power of these very, very large military contractors is extraordinary. They have great influence over public policy. As Tom indicated, the media plays right along, and the fear-mongering under the Bush administration especially has been horrendous. And we just got to fight through the media and inform people that while we need a strong defense, it is also important that we invest in many, many other areas, that just throwing money at the military is not being patriotic. They're going to preemptive wars is not necessarily in America's interest because it provokes outrage all over the world against our policies. Overthrowing governments preemptively is not necessarily in our interest. So there's a lot of work to be done in that area. But Tom is right in saying that it's not only the military-industrial complex. You got to throw the media in there as well.
Excuse me, Chuck, in Venice, California. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to know how we are going to eliminate the sense of fear that's been promulgated in this country over the last 8 years, and what would you advise the next president to do to regain our stature in the world?
Well, I think that's a good question, and certainly, unless I'm very mistaken, the mantra of the Republican candidate for president of the United States will have a lot to do with fear. Then, unless we spend huge sums of money on the military, we're going to be quote unquote soft on terrorism and weak on terrorism, and you can't vote for anybody who doesn't want to spend all that kind of money and so forth. I think there are two answers. I think for a start, the American people have got to understand that our middle class, our working class is falling further and further behind many other countries in terms of our standard of living, in terms of our lack of health care, in terms of educational opportunity for our people. We've got to understand that we have the resources to improve the standard of living of the middle class rather than just upper-income people. And I think the second point is that we are not going to be successful in fighting international terrorism unless there is a coming together of countries all over the world. And therefore, we have got to be part of that process, not just dictating what goes on.
Brilliant. Well, very well said. Thank you so much, Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, good. Talk
Sanders, to you. Thank you. Sanders.Senate.gov.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The debates last night, Democratic debates, some interesting moments. I thought it was a fascinating debate. It seemed to me that there was the low point in the debate was when Hillary pulled out her lines that frankly, I don't think she came up with. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that, you know, campaign consultants, rather nasty campaign consultants that come up with. You're Xeroxing other people's speeches, and your speeches should be your own words. And Barack Obama did, in response to that, what, frankly, I try to do on this program in so many of the debates that I have with conservatives and even from time to time with progressives, and that is ask the question, well, what's the larger issue here? You know, let's take this out to the bigger picture. What's this really all about? And it's really not all about this little stuff. What it's really all about, you know, whether or not my campaign, co-chair of my campaign and good friend suggested that I use a line in a speech. It's not about that. It's about what we're going to do, for the American people. And Hillary actually got booed last night when she said it. And, I thought that was very, very interesting. I also, you notice, I mean, if you watch the thing, that when she came out on stage, a lot of applause. I'm guessing that they had probably tried to make sure that the audience was equally balanced between Obama supporters and Clinton supporters. But when he came out on the stage, when he stepped up on the stage, the crowd went nuts. And he was waving at people while she was clapping. It was just, I mean, just watching the whole body language of the whole thing was fascinating. Fascinating. From the body language of it, I got the sense that she has the feeling that she is very behind and may not catch up. It's just the sense I got from watching it. And I think one of the real healing moments, and perhaps one of the most insightful moments, was at the very end of the speech. When, to wrap the speech up, she turned to Barack Obama and said,
I am honored to be here with Barack Obama. I am absolutely honored. And, you know, whatever happens, we're going to be fine. You know, we have strong support from our families and our friends. I just hope that we'll be able to say the same thing about the American people. And that's what this election should be about.
And that was brilliant. That was absolutely brilliant. I mean, and then the other thing, this just, you know, blew my mind. I mean, where did my pile go? Here it is right here. The USA Today, the headline, Clinton, Obama sharpen words, Democrats spar over plagiarism allegations. That's the headline. Well, frankly, I thought that the important part of last night was where they spent a good chunk of the debate, and they kept coming back to it, about their differences on health care. And, you know, ultimately for policy wonks and whatnot, for those of us who really follow this stuff, I mean, that's pretty important stuff. Ultimately, though, whoever becomes president is probably not going to end up, in fact, almost certainly will not end up with whatever they're putting forward right now as their platform, because there's going to be a process where other people come into play on this, particularly those people who make laws in the United States, which ain't the president of the United States, with the singular exception, I guess, these days of George Bush with his executive orders and signing statements. But, you know, that lunacy hopefully will be put to an end 332 days, 10 hours, 42 minutes and 8 seconds from now when he officially leaves office, barring impeachment, of course. But the important stuff of the debates was the issues stuff. And, you know, they kept coming back to those things, but that's not what was at the top of USA Today. So it's just, you know, infotainment isn't infotainment. You know, we're all about infotainment. It's the infotainment world, et cetera, et cetera. And I just, you know, it seemed kind of sad to me, frankly, that, you know, it's become all about infotainment. I mean, we're better than that. I really think we're better than that. Marcus in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Marcus, you wanted to mention the Texas students. I had that in my stack of stuff to talk about yesterday and never got to it.
Oh, okay.
Fire away.
Oh, well, great. I just wanted to bring it to your attention because the video out on YouTube, well, the video is about students from Prairie View A&M University, and I'm a graduate. The school is a historically black college, 110, 112 years old. And the students, as opposed to other schools in Texas, like Texas A&M, UT, those universities have polls directly on the campus. Right. They had taken out all of the polls in the county and moved them all to one specific city 7 miles away. So the students marched the 7 miles from the campus to the polls, about 200 or 300 of them. The rest of them drove. The thing about it was that a couple of posters on YouTube had mentioned you, Tom Hartman, by saying, you know, by using your quote, "Activism begins with you," tagged
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah.
And they're saying that the students were taking you up on that action. I mean, that's been the history of that school. So.
Yeah, it's a marvelous school, and it's mind-boggling that you would have an entire college where, you know, and most students don't have cars. I mean,
yep.
You know, this isn't rocket science. You go to college, you're living on campus, you walk to your classes, you don't have a car. And so, gee, let's put the polling booth 7 miles away. I mean, there's something really stinky about that whole thing, you know, something really fishy about it. And the students brilliantly demonstrated that. And it was a marvelous photograph in the pay. I believe it was an AP photo and an AP story that I had yesterday in my stack. And I haven't seen the YouTube thing on it, but it is... It is there. It is true. And it's just that's just the bigger story, Marcus, is that that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Precisely.
I mean, the fact of the matter is that the whole Republican strategy is to suppress the vote. And in fact, Marcus, thanks for calling and bringing this up. This is Paul Weyrich. Paul Weyrich is the guy. He was a direct mail guy back in the Reagan days. He took credit for helping Reagan become president. He's been a major consultant to every Republican presidential candidate since then. He will be working on this presidential campaign. Here's Paul Weyrich speaking to a group of Republican activists and Republican Party leaders in a church.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And that's the bottom line. The Republicans have an agenda which is absolutely inconsistent with the best interests of the vast majority of Americans. It works just fine if your income is over seven figures. If you make more than $1 million a year, then you'd be crazy not to be a Republican. If you make more than $1 billion a year, I mean, how is it that Warren Buffett's a Democrat and the guy, you know, the guy's making billions of dollars a year? Well, he's got a conscience, or George Soros. I guess, you know, they understand that frankly, even the, I guess the Democratic... Here's the point. The Republican Party's policies of borrow like crazy in order to transfer wealth to very rich and powerful people and corporations and institutions and families with inherited wealth and leave the bill to the middle class and tax the middle class for this. That strategy, you know, I said if you're a millionaire, you'd be crazy not to be a Republican. Actually, you still would be crazy to be a Republican. Let me correct myself on the air here within a minute of having said it. Because the Republican policies, while over the short term they look like they're good news for millionaires and billionaires, over the long term they're going to be a disaster for them too. They are destroying this country. They're hollowing out our industrial infrastructure. They're hollowing out our educational infrastructure. We're not producing, you know, they're destroying the entire infrastructure of our nation, whether it's bridges in Minnesota, or whether it's schools in every city in America, or whether it's our roads that communities are now selling off and privatizing to companies based in Spain and France who are taking the profits out of this country. I mean, it is absolutely crazy, the whole agenda of the Republican Party. And now they're going to field a candidate, John McCain, who has more lobbyists working on his campaign and who has taken more money from lobbyists than any other candidate in the entire field, even more than Mitt Romney and, I mean, even all of the Republican candidates. He is the most of all the candidates, Democratic or Republican, of the you know, dozen and a half people who started this race. He is the one who is most lobbyist up. There's the old phrase, lawyered up. There needs to be a lobbyist equivalent to it. Most in bed with the largest number of lobbyists. And, you know, it's kind of odd and bizarre and I suppose tragic in a kind of strange way that it took his actually probably getting into bed with a lobbyist to cause it to make the news. But he's... John McCain is the guy who's really been in bed, you know, financially speaking, metaphorically speaking, with the lobbyists all along. I mean, there's been no straight talk. Come on, give me a break. And so, anyway, but back to why the Republicans want to suppress the vote. Well, because they're not operating in our interest. It's just that simple. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
Stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
That's Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number, Adam in Westfield, New Jersey. Hey, Adam, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how are you today?
Just great, but I'll get better.
All right. I'm kind of jealous that you get to vent all day on the radio like this.
Well, but, yeah. We all get to vet. We all know people we can vet at.
There's just a couple of things I wanted to mention real quickly, and then I'll let you go so you can respond if you just indulge me for a minute.
Sure.
With John McCain, I've spoken to folks that were POWs in Vietnam, and many of them consider themselves survivors, not heroes.
Right.
And I was wondering why he's put up on this pedestal and why that can't, you know, to me, he's not a hero. He was someone whose job was to kill Vietnamese, right?
And drop bombs on them. If you go back and you look on, if you go to TomHartman.com and click on my blog and scroll back to last week, there is about an 8-minute YouTube on there, of interviews with a whole bunch of POWs, a few who were there with McCain, saying, "Hey, wait a minute, he's not what you think." And I asked the question when I put it up, you know, is this Swift Boaty McCain? Is this nonsense or is this real? Because I honestly don't, you know, I'm not a scholar of John McCain's military career, but it sure was thought provoking. And
I just had two other quick things. I was wondering if you saw the O'Reilly so-called apology about his remarks about lynching, not going on a lynching party about Michelle Obama.
Was this last night?
Yeah, it was sort of an apology. If
yeah,
I
no,
offended anybody, I'm sorry.
No, I didn't see it. Instead, I went to see this amazing movie about Darfur called The Devil Came on Horseback. And let me recommend everybody go to thedevilcameonhorseback.com and watch the trailer for this amazing movie.
But where's Al Sharpton on this?
But anyhow, you said O'Reilly apologized last night. Here's his comment, first of all, just so those people who don't know what we're talking about. Day before yesterday, Bill O'Reilly said this on the radio.
And I don't want to go on a lynching party against Michelle Obama unless there's evidence, hard facts, that say this is how the woman really feels. If that's how she really feels, that America's a bad country or a flawed nation, whatever, then that's legit. We'll track it down. 1-877-9-NO-SPIN, right back.
And that was that.
So he doesn't want to lynch her unless she said that, then he'll track her down and lynch her.
That's right. And that's and I said on the air yesterday, it'll be interesting to see if Bill O'Reilly's still on the air tomorrow. And what was announced late yesterday afternoon, is that Bill O'Reilly will not be on the air on Fridays any longer, that Tony Snow is taking his place. So he's lost 20% of his show, and I have a feeling that it ties right back to this incident, because this isn't the first time. I mean, you know, O'Reilly's also, you know, his comments about when he went to Sylvia's restaurant, I guess it was, and he was just all astounded that the African Americans were actually having, you know, eating with utensils, and having, you know, it was really pretty pretty bizarre.
Hello?
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, one last comment, and sorry everyone else for being greedy, but I was wondering if you're hearing this a lot. When I voted here in New Jersey in the primary, I didn't make my mind up until I was actually in the booth with the curtain closed, and then I held it against Hillary Clinton, her authorization for Iraq, and then I voted for Obama, and I was wondering if you're hearing that a lot. I'll let you go.
Thank you, Adam. Yeah, I appreciate the call. You know, I have heard that from some people, and it's sort of like the oh damn test, right? It's like, how do you access your unconscious? Well, here's how. If you don't know how to make a decision, and you know you've got two choices, it's a binary decision. Take out a coin and just say, okay, heads it's A and tails it's B. You know, heads it's Clinton, tails it's Obama in this case. You flip the coin. Put it, you know, slap it on your hand. You don't know what it's going to say, right? You take your hand off, and when you look and you see, oh, it's heads, or oh, it's tails, an immediate thought will flash through your mind, which is like either oh, great, or oh, damn, and that, then you know how you really feel. So there's your little tip for the day on how to access your unconscious. Jake in Nyack, New York, you wanted to talk about Sybil Edmonds, who's been on this show, a guest a number of times, and will be again soon. Go ahead, Jake.
Yeah, I think there's been a couple of interesting developments, and ever since she has been spotlighted in 60 Minutes and Vanity Fair, you know, a lot more specifics have come out.
Yeah.
And
she's come out now and said that she's going to talk about the things that it was illegal for her to talk about, and she was restraining herself from before, and she has, in fact. And we do need to get her back on the show to talk about that stuff. I just didn't, at that point in time, I didn't want to go through the whole background with Bernie, and because he wasn't familiar with it, bring him up to date. I'll send the information off to his staff to pass along to him. But
yeah, I think it's really Leahy that needs to maybe make some public discussion about it, because from the reason,
and it would be my guess that Leahy knows about her because he's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and that's.
Yeah, well, exactly. From the reading I've done, it seems as though he originally entertained her and a lot of the information, and then backed off of that.
Yeah, and Waxman also in the House of Representatives, Henry Waxman, had said back about 2 or 3 years ago that, you know, if she came out with this stuff and the Democrats got control of Congress, that he would hold hearings on it. He has not yet held hearings on it. I think in part, perhaps, I think here's where some of the politicians are getting spooky around Sybil. And Jake, thanks for the call. Is that because she has now said that she's willing to, and in fact in some areas has, violated her oath of secrecy in public, I'm just speculating here, but my guess is that there's some concern among some politicians that this is becoming radioactive. We'll see. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Yesterday we had the spectacle on television. We haven't seen it in a while, but many of us have seen it far too often in our lives, of a U.S. embassy on fire. And I wanted to get a little background from somebody who really knows this stuff. P.J. Crowley is with us. He's a senior fellow and director of Homeland Security at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. But beyond that, during the Clinton administration, he was special assistant to the President of the United States for National Security Affairs, served as senior director of public affairs for the National Security Council. Before that, he was principal deputy assistant secretary of defense for public affairs. And this is a guy who knows his stuff. P.J. Crowley, welcome to the program.
A pleasure, Tom.
Glad to have you with us. What happened?
Well, Kosovo is an issue that we've been wrestling with for more than 20 years. It was a danger in the late 80s when Slobodan Milosevic ran for the president of the rump state of Yugoslavia, wanting to go refight a battle that happened in 1387. It was a crisis 9 years ago when he practiced ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, and that led to a U.S. and NATO intervention in 1999, and it's been a challenge ever since to try to figure out how to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And unfortunately, despite a lot of extraordinary effort by Europeans led by a skilled diplomat, Matti Ahtisaari, and the United States was a participant as well through a guy named Frank Wisner, we arrived at the only real viable option left, which was Kosovo independence. And obviously it's something that is very emotional, very wrenching, for the Serbians. They are the big losers here, but first and foremost, if they're angry, they should look at their own nationalistic policies.
Yeah, Serbia has historically, at least in recent history, I guess since the 1300s, considered Kosovo part of their historic heartland. And in fact, there are a number of Serbian Orthodox church sites in Kosovo that are considered major big deals there. I mean, this is to what extent does that play into their going after our embassy over this? And we should note, by the way, that 17 of the 27 countries in the EU have recognized Kosovo's independence, but a bunch of others have not. In fact, Spain has called it illegal, as have Slovakia, Romania, Cyprus. To what extent is this just the Bush administration screwing up? You know, the Bush rushing out to recognize the independence of Kosovo, perhaps a day or two before he should have, you know, just let things settle down. I mean, isn't there a lesson here from World War One in a way? I mean, the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo bringing the world down for reasons that to this day I can't figure out.
Well, I certainly, obviously, if you have a demonstrated policy of supporting democracy around the world, then actually I think that, supporting the independence of Kosovo under the right circumstances is a far more defensible position than, say, continuing to support a dictator in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So in this particular case, I think the United States did the only thing that it could. The Serbs have been mad at the United States for 10 years, or 15 years ever since we intervened in Bosnia. So I don't think that yesterday was necessarily a surprise. I think really the real issue here is twofold. One is for the Serbian government and the Serbian people. If they're going to look backwards and be captives to 700 years of history, that will be unfortunate for them. If they are going to look forward, and I think there is a leader in President Tadic in Serbia that wants to push his country towards membership eventually in the European Union. Obviously, for the United States, a peaceful, stable, integrated Europe is absolutely positively in our self-interest. So, given that this has been percolating for several years and there's been some very significant effort, by European governments, by the United States government, I can't fault what has happened here. I think this rests squarely on the shoulders of the Serbs and the nationalistic tendencies they've shown over the past few years that brought them to this point.
Yeah. The closest I've been into this area was last summer. We were in Dubrovnik in Croatia. And my understanding is that the Kosovo is a lot of ethnic Albanians, a lot of Muslims, that Serbia is Christian and has racial would be the wrong phrase, but more of a kind of a historical, cultural, and biological by migration connection to Russia.
Right.
And the Kosovars are more connected to the Middle East, shall we say.
To Albania.
Yeah, to Albania. And to what extent is that behind all this, and to what extent might that cause Russia to get into the act here? Certainly they have in the past.
Sure, sure. I mean, you know, the Balkans are messy. I mean, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, and there's so much history there. It you know, I mean, to some extent, think of it this way. You know, Kosovo to the Serbs is like Jerusalem to any number of groups.
Right.
Very sacred territory, and so this is wrenching. This is emotional. No question about it. And the other end of this is, in fact, this is really the last option. It's not necessarily the best option. I mean, 10 years ago, we in the Clinton administration thought the best option was to return Kosovo to stable autonomy within Serbia. It didn't, you know, obviously because of the extent of ethnic cleansing, there was just no trust left between the Kosovars and the Serbs. So this is not a great option. It's the only option that's on the table. But really, that puts also an imperative on the Kosovo government, because they do have ethnic minorities, 100,000 or more Serbs who are in the north of Kosovo in a place called Mitrovica, and they're going to have to protect them. And, and it is something that we take for granted here in the United States. It's something that is quite foreign. So on the one hand, the good news here is that we've had a relatively stable situation in the Balkans for the last 7, 8, 9, 10 years, but by no means are these scores settled. And you saw yesterday some very raw emotions that still exist and some unsettled issues that will have to be resolved peacefully over time. And this may take another, you know, 10, 20, 30 years to sort itself out.
Yeah, we saw that same thing in Croatia. In fact, we did our radio show for 4 days live from
absolutely.
Croatia.
And 9 years ago, I happened to be working for the NATO Secretary General during the Kosovo conflict. I remember vividly walking through the camps of displaced persons in Albania, in Macedonia. Mm-hmm. And like I say, I understand that Serbia today is not the Serbia that existed 10 years ago. But by the same token, if the Serbs are unhappy, they really have to look themselves in the mirror, because this is a direct result of what happened through the inflammation of their nationalism 10 years ago under Milosevic, and it is a tragedy, but nonetheless, it's now time for them to look ahead to a better future as part of Europe.
And the memories are long. I mean, the Croats are still there. There are still areas of that country that were destroyed during the war that they're preserving as destroyed, and the old city of Dubrovnik, you know, all the
that's right,
you know, where it was bombed and all the bullet holes and things, instead of fixing them like Germany did after World War II in large part, they're making them into monuments.
Right, it's important to put the, you know, who's recognized and who hasn't in some context. I mean, we for the United States are on a relative basis free of the same kind of ethnic tension and religious history that some of the other countries have, but Russia, while their public comments yesterday were not helpful at all, on the other hand, they have their own set of challenges inside the Russian Federation. They've got a lot of rest of republics who will be looking at Kosovo and saying, hey, if them, why not us? You know, and that's similar with, you know, you have in Spain, for example, the Basque population. So,
yep.
You know, there's some hesitancy here, but by the same token, I think this was the right signal for the United States to take. I can't fault the Bush administration in this case, but we obviously ought to be consistent. If we're promoting, you know, independence and autonomy in places like Kosovo, we certainly have to be supporting civil society in a place like Pakistan.
Well said. Well said. P.J. Crowley from the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Thanks so much for being with us, sir.
Tom, a pleasure.
Great talking with you today. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, 43 minutes past the hour. And Michael in Hollywood, California. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hey, how you doing, Tom? I'm so happy you're taking people's calls and giving people a voice. I really appreciate it. First, I guess I should clarify. A few weeks ago, I called in and I said that at the Las Vegas debate, they asked with a prequel that the number one job is to protect the people of the United States. That's actually not what happened. Hillary actually began her answer saying that her number one job was to protect the people of the United States, and that's why I voted for Barack Obama. But then last night at the debate, he said the same thing.
I know.
And I'm really upset about this because, I mean, it's like they're running for dictator at this point, because if they're not going to return the Constitution to what it was, then the economy, everything doesn't matter.
Right. And in fact, in terms of the number one job of the United States, Article 2 of the Constitution, which defines the executive branch, the presidency, Section 1, Paragraph 8, before he enter into the execution of his office, he shall take the following oath or affirmation. And this defines the number one job of the president, right? Quote, I do, and this is, I'm reading from the Constitution, quote, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and to the best of my ability preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Not the people.
That's right. Period. End of quote.
This is just so scary to me, Tom, because the news media isn't talking. When they put these debates up, these questions don't come up.
That's right. This is symbolic
the
of how
people are running. They don't talk about it.
I know, Michael, and you know what Barack Obama was doing last night was pandering to, I use that word advisedly, to pandering to people who are afraid for security. You know, they want a strong executive in commander in chief. And frankly, I think that I know that he gets it, and Hillary Clinton get it, that their first job is to defend the Constitution. There's no doubt in my mind. I think it's a tragedy that they have to use language like this to get elected, because Americans are so ignorant of their own Constitution.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Now, Larry Craig scares me, the senator from Idaho. All his Republican buddies are telling him he's gotta go. You see, they think that being gay is some kind of disgrace. All around the Senate and the House, they make that case. The fact is, they've got enormous closet space, and that scares me. Dick Cheney scares me with those beady eyes. They get intense and glary every time he lies, which is like every day now. He's got a machine where his heart should be, just pumping out an evil philosophy. He shoots people in the face and gets away scot-free, and he scares me.
Anybody else?
Holder scares me.
Oh yeah, me too.
And now I gotta be blunt. In my frank opinion, she's just a stupid pundit. And in the time of my day, she isn't worth the tick, 'cause she's nothing but a carny with a hate-filled shtick. But she sold a couple million books, and that's just sick. She scares me. But wait a minute, the Democrats scare me.
Uh-oh.
Up there on Capitol Hill, won't do what's necessary, and probably never will. Bunch of Casper milk toasts. They're all politicians, and that's the bottom line. When it comes to Bush and Cheney, all they do is whine. They'd impeach the bum if any of them had a spine, and they scare me.
Yes, and welcome back. 51 minutes past the hour, and you know it scares me. Well, actually, it doesn't. I think it's rather pathetic. Our O'Reilly alert for the day.
You're a monster, Mr. Grinch.
Mr. O'Reilly. Well.
Your heart's an empty hole. Your brain is full of spiders. You've got garlic in your soul, Mr. Grinch. I wouldn't touch you with a 39 and a half foot pole.
Yes, our new official O'Reilly alert music. Last night, Bill O'Reilly seemingly apologized for saying that he would consider lynching Michelle Obama if he could get the evidence. Here's what he said.
Political. So I defended Mrs. Obama on both radio and TV. While talking to a radio caller, I said there should be no lynching in the case. I comment off Clarence Thomas saying he was the victim of a high-tech lynch.
Wait a second. While talking to a caller, I said there should be no lynching in the case. Did I hear that right?
Defended Mrs. Obama on both radio and TV. While talking to a radio caller, I said there should be no lynching in the case. That comment off Clarence Thomas, saying he was the victim of a high-tech lynching. He said that on 60 Minutes, you may remember. I'm sorry if my statement offended anybody. That, of course, was not the intention. Context is everything.
Yes, context is everything. So you said there should be no lynching of Michelle Obama. Interesting. Now, let's just step into the Wayback Machine here.
And I don't want to go on a lynching party against Michelle Obama unless there's evidence, hard facts, that say this is how the woman really feels. If that's how she really feels, that America's a bad country or a flawed nation, whatever, then that's legit.
Yeah, our Bill O'Reilly alert for the day.
You're a monster, Mr. Grinch.
So 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, and Larry in Glendale, California. Hey, Larry, what's
up? What scares me is that you let this get by, that when Hillary's final thing where everybody got up, and I think everybody stood up because it was the end of the speech, but maybe it was those rousing lines, and you said they were absolutely brilliant. Remember?
Which
this morning?
You'll have to, I've...
Well, you played back the end of the debate. And
yes, where Hillary said that she was honored to be on the stage with Barack Obama.
She wasn't worried about herself, and she shouldn't worry about Obama or not.
Right, right.
It's the people.
Right.
That's lifted directly from John Edwards. And he said that in his speech three times that I heard.
Oh, that's
interesting. And that was plagiarized. So the irony of her getting this rousing cheers for a plagiarized thing after attacking him for plagiarizing, essentially telling Jay Leno he shouldn't use what his writers wrote.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting, Larry. And I've heard her on a number of occasions say, it's personal for me, which is also one of his signature phrases. I don't have any problem with it. If there's a good line out there, I want more politicians, frankly, to be plagiarizing Dwight Eisenhower. You know? I mean, I am ready to hear some politicians say that they're...
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
I'm ready for some plagiarism. I want to hear it. Evan in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Evan. No Evan. Okay, Martha in Grand Rapids, Michigan, WTKG. Hey, Martha.
Hey, good to be on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would trust Barack Obama with our Constitution. One of his qualifications that I haven't seen listed, and lately the lists are going around, I heard you the other day, was that he taught constitutional law in a law school in Chicago.
I did not know that.
And so, I mean, I think that's a really great part of his resume during the time he was state senator.
Yeah. And that was my point, is he knows that the first job of the president is not to protect the United States.
Exactly.
I mean, being commander in chief, you know, it's a little down the list. The first job of the United States, or the president of the United States, is to protect and defend the Constitution. And that's the only oath that he swears to. He doesn't swear to protect America.
In his stump speech, which finally we heard in full the other night, in his stump speech, he mentioned getting his habeas corpus back.
Right.
Which, you know, I'd appreciate.
Yeah, defending the Constitution. Yes, so would I. Defending the Constitution, what a novel idea. Martha, thank you very much. Mary in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Mary, we've got about a half a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour.
Good morning. I want to know what, without impeachment of these groups, what about the pardons they're going to give?
Pardons are the only power that a president has that's left over from the old days of kings. And there was a rousing debate about it in the Constitutional Convention. Should we give such a kingly power to the president? And the decision ultimately was yes, that we will take that one single power that kings have to pardon. And therefore, once a pardon has been issued, it cannot be unissued, to the best of my knowledge. There might be some weird, bizarre exception to that, but I don't think so. I'm pretty sure that that's the end of it. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Call 866-303-2270.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back to our program. 6 minutes past the hour. Just a couple things that I wanted to share with you before we get back to your phone calls here on Anything Goes Friday. The first is from the Financial Times today, page 4, the headline right at the top of the page, U.S. misled London on rendition flights. Christy Harvey and I talked about this briefly yesterday, but this has become a really big deal in the United Kingdom. And this, the Financial Times has an even greater stature around the world than the Wall Street Journal. It's sort of the Wall Street Journal of the United Kingdom, but everybody knows that it's not owned by Rupert Murdoch, and it's taken very, very seriously. So let me just, I'll just share with you two paragraphs, a couple of paragraphs out of this article by Alex Baker and Jimmy Burns in London, George Parker in Brussels, and Daniel Dombey in Washington. The headline in the Financial Times, and you can read this over at FT.com as well, U.S. misled London on rendition flights. The U.S. admitted yesterday to inadvertently misleading the British government by using UK territory to refuel two rendition flights carrying alleged terrorists without informing ministers. The disclosure forced David Miliband, the UK Foreign Secretary, this would be the equivalent of their Secretary of State. And when they say not informing ministers, that's what they mean, you know, cabinet office, what we would call cabinet officers. Prompted David Miliband, the UK Foreign Secretary, to apologize to Parliament, and prompted furious responses from senior members of Parliament accusing the U.S. of, quote, deception and, quote, lying. Some U.S. officials were taken aback by the vehement criticisms yesterday expressed by MPs, members of Parliament, particularly those questioning the credibility of their main ally. Gordon Brown, British Prime Minister, said such renditions from UK territory were, quote, a very serious issue, end quote, and promised to put in place procedures to ensure it would, quote, never happen again, end quote. And then the article later on goes on to point out a Council of Europe report in 2006 accused 14 European countries, including the UK, Germany, Italy, and Sweden, of cooperating with extrajudicial abductions, claiming that Diego Garcia had been used. The allegations were strenuously denied. And then this is where it gets really shocking. This is amazing. Right here in the Financial Times. British intelligence officers. Now, keep in mind, Ellen Ratner's brother, Michael Ratner, he's the head of the Center for Constitutional Rights out of New York. And he's the guy who tried to get Don Rumsfeld prosecuted in the world court and you know, pursued him in Germany and pursued him in France. Well, here, from the Financial Times. Today's Financial Times, British intelligence officers have been advised by government lawyers that any direct involvement in rendition leading to torture would leave them liable to prosecution under European human rights laws, according to intelligence sources. End of quote from the Financial Times. So the British are now concerned that their intelligence officers could be prosecuted under the EU laws on human rights. I mean, they're really nervous. They're getting, you know, downright skittery over there. I wanted to share that story with you. And then here's the other one. And this one is just downright weird. Let me just preface this by saying, I don't think that there is a conspiracy within the Secret Service to get Barack Obama killed. But this is just totally bizarre. Dateline Dallas. This is from today's Star Telegram. You can read it over at star-telegram.com. The Dallas-Fort Worth Star Telegram, you know, the newspaper in town, by Jack Douglas Jr., Star Telegram staff writer. Security details at Barack Obama's rally Wednesday stopped screening people for weapons at the front gates more than an hour before the Democratic presidential candidate took the stage at Reunion Arena. The order to put down the metal detectors and stop checking purses and laptop bags came as a surprise to several Dallas police officers who said they believed it was a lapse in security. Dallas Police Chief T.W. Lawrence, head of the police department's Homeland Security and Special Operations Division, said the order, apparently made by the U.S. Secret Service, was meant to speed up the long lines outside and fill the arena's vacant seats before Obama came on. Sure, said Lawrence when asked if he was concerned by the great number of people who had gotten into the building without being checked. But, he added, The turnout of more than 17,000 people seemed to be a, quote, friendly crowd, end quote. Secret Service did not return a call from the Star-Telegram seeking comment. Interesting. I'll just, you know, like I said, I'm not going to go off into some conspiracy theory on this. I think this is just a major screw-up, but it's a major screw-up. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. And let's see here, Randy in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Randy, what's on your mind today?
I was thinking about what you were asking about the limits of the pardon power.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping you could ask one of your legal eagles when they get on whether you can pardon yourself for your own crime, or more to the point, any otherwise legal act becomes a crime when done in furtherance of a conspiracy.
Yeah, I'm quite sure that the president cannot pardon himself or herself.
Well, right, but if the pardon is offered as a quo quid quo, or in exchange for bribe, or in exchange for scurrilously silence, the offer and the acceptance of that pardon would be an additional crime which would not be covered by the pardon itself. Mm. Pardons would be only for past acts, not for current or future acts.
Well, actually, Gerald Ford's pardon of Richard Nixon, well, no, it was retroactive, but it covered all the things that had not even been brought up. Basically, he said, you can't prosecute this guy for anything. And, of course, Nixon thought he couldn't. I mean, you know, it's...
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
Nixon's famous quote, you know.
That's right. We all have opinions about our own actions. But
yeah.
if you could demonstrate that Scooter Libby's commutation or future pardon were in exchange for silence, then that offer and acceptance of the pardon would be an additional act of that conspiracy and not covered by the pardon.
Right, or the pardon may stand, but the prosecution for the conspiracy could go forward.
As a new count. That's
right, yeah. I think, frankly, that's how it would work out. But Marjorie Cohen is the person that we usually turn to for constitutional law matters, and we want to get back, thanks a lot for the call, I want to get back into the habit of having her on the show every couple of weeks and asking her, you know, these kinds of large issue questions because she really knows her stuff. Keith in Livonia, Michigan. Hey, Keith, what's up? Keith, you're on the air. No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
Yes, you are. Okay.
Yes, thank you, Tom. It's great to talk to you again.
Thank you.
I'd hope to get feedback from my remarks from Senator Sanders, so it's my hope that you can pass along the essence of my remarks later. I think it was great that you folks were airing these classic Eisenhower quotes that have long been cited by the by disarmament advocates. I would remind you, though, that President Eisenhower was also the one who brought us Atoms for Peace, which led to the development of the U.S. civilian nuclear power industry, which was once described by Forbes magazine as the largest managerial disaster in U.S. business history.
Well, and it's also one that can't exist without government supports. If we took away the Price-Anderson Nuclear Insurance Act, or whatever it's called, it's the Price-Anderson Act, which basically says that because no insurance company in the world is crazy enough to insure a nuclear power plant, we're going to stick that liability to the American people. So if there's a meltdown, the government will be the insurer for the power plants. If you took that away, nobody would build a nuclear power plant.
Right.
Nobody. Because it just is nuts.
I wanted to also add to your and the senator's litany regarding nuclear power, and then I'll follow up with the essence that I was referring to earlier. Yucca Mountain is the product of 50 years of scientific research by the best scientific minds that this country has to offer. And we've ended up with a site that is riddled with earthquake faults, groundwater contamination, whatnot. And another lie that is being commonly spread about is that nuclear power is the solution to global warming. Yet the Massachusetts Institute of Technology did a study a couple of years ago, I think it was, that said that essentially 1,500 new nuclear power plants would have to be built globally. And I believe it was hundreds in the U.S., not just dozens.
Right. And then we'd be down to a 20-year supply of uranium for the world, A.
Right.
And B, building those plants, extracting that uranium, and processing that uranium is done with oil. And this is Helen Caldicott's point, is that it is year 16 in the lifetime of a power plant before it generates its first watt of electricity that isn't basically oil converted into the creation of the nuclear power plant and the purification of the nuclear fuel. where it's actually electricity coming from nuclear energy. The nuclear power plants use enormous amounts of carbon. And it's just so wrong. I mean, nuclear power is no answer to anything other than a few billionaires and big transnational corporations and companies like General Electric, who own NBC, who want to, you know, have a government bailout if they get in trouble with the Price-Anderson Act and want some government handouts over the short term.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Oh, this is interesting. SS409 in the chat room, he says, or she says, I don't know which it is. Here's a thought. The Cold War ended this week. Castro won. Yeah, that's one way of looking at it. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
When you were talking to P.J. Crowley, I was rather taken aback and actually quite bothered by the way he presented the situation with the Serbs and the Kosovites. He,
like it's, you know, nasty Serbia, it's all their fault.
Yeah, I mean, he neglected to talk about he talked about Serbia going back almost 1,000 years, but neglected that the Kosovites aligned themselves, well, some of the Kosovites aligned themselves with the Nazis during World War II.
Well, so did the Croats.
Excuse me?
So did the Croats.
Well, the Croats, I mean, if you look at the whole area, everybody's a victim and everybody's a villain.
But the Croats are more ethnically German. I mean, German is spoken all over Croatia.
Yeah, the Croats did horrible things. The Kosovites did horrible things. The Serbs have done horrible things. And when you go to that region, and you went to Dubrovnik last year, I'm sure you talked to people about this, some of this. Yeah, like if you just go to neighboring countries like Greece or Bulgaria, the locals there say, hey, you Americans are clueless about this. So, yep. You know, you see it that the Serbs are all bad guys. And the Serbs did do awful things, but it's not as simple as we see.
Well, yeah, and that's because Milosevic got all the TV time.
Yes.
You know, from when he was starving people out in cities, right up through when he was in the docket in the International World Court. I mean, Milosevic was the guy who got all the press time, at least in the United States. And so we tend to think of it as, oh, he was the Hitler of the region, and he was the bad guy, and therefore Serbia must be the bad guys. And
but when you see what the Croats did in World War II and so forth, and on, it's been going back and forth for a long time.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
People, there have been horrible places where people were really, the Serbs were bad victims. The Croats have been victims. The Kosovites have been victims, but they've also been the villains.
Mm-hmm. Is it Kosovites or Kosovars?
It's referred to as both ways. They would say like Kosovar Albanians.
I see.
And, but also, you know, I'm not sure what the proper thing is, but I've heard seen Kosovite and Kosovar.
Yeah, interesting.
But
Jeff, thanks.
They say it's a very, very different story than what we see. And, you know, you go to Greece and they laugh at us.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, yeah. And it's like pretty much every other region of the world as well. You know, whether it's Central America or South America or the Middle East or whatever, Americans tend to have this very, very watered down. I mean, we have got nothing like the BBC here. You turn to CNN Headline News, and instead of Headline News, you get Glenn Beck. I mean, you know, it's just totally bizarre. We don't even have a news channel in this country anymore. And what we have, you know, is diluted. Even NPR now is sponsored by big corporations that they're afraid to take on. You know, it's downright tragic. Jeff, thank you for interjecting a few more thoughts into this. I appreciate it. It's always nice to hear from you. Krista in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Krista.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of talk about the Secret Service asking police in Texas to step down at the Obama rally.
Right.
And in your earlier broadcast for the local show here in Portland, you kind of talked about remembering the Kennedy and MLK assassinations. And
yeah.
That you kind of wondered what the 20-something, if they...
Yeah, for all of our listeners who don't know the context, Krista, can I just revisit that real quickly
before you
go into your riff? Carl Wolfson does our morning show here along with me, he does all 3 hours. I do the last hour with him, and Heidi Tauber as co-hosts. And Carl and I are about the same age. We're both in our 50s, and we were talking about our experience of when Kennedy was assassinated. Carl was 10, I was 9 years old, and how both of us, and I think our entire generation, has, between Jack Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King's assassinations, has a collective post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, PTSD around that, that when we see Barack Obama, who seems to, frankly, embody all three of those men in different regards, you know, his the oratorical skills of Martin Luther King, the charisma of Jack Kennedy, and the social conscience of Bobby Kennedy, we see, and of course you can attribute all three of those characteristics to all three of them in other ways as well, but you see that, and he's and then you discover that the security has been told to stand down, and it's just like there's this collective flinch among people who are old enough to remember those assassinations. And so I said on the air, I wonder if, you know, the 20 something generation, the 30 something generation, people are not old enough to remember that, you know, what their reaction would be. And so that's what you're calling to share with us.
Yes. Well, I'm 24, and I was actually just talking to my mom about this same thing like 2 or 3 weeks ago. I was saying that it's so wonderful that we have, you know, the first possibility of a woman president or a black person as president.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I was, you know, just kind of telling her, at the same time, I'm really worried, because when we look at anybody who's really stood for dramatic change or progress in our history, those people have been assassinated. And I gave her the examples of, you know, JFK and of Martin Luther King. And even just with the recent assassination of Benazir Bhutto, even though it's not in America, it's just like, it's, you know, like a looming presence.
So in other words, your generation is flinching as much as mine is about the fact that the Secret Service said to stand down.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for the reality check, Krista. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. And thanks for listening to KPOJ here. And you're there in Vancouver, Washington, right across the river from us here in Portland, Oregon. Oh, my. Oh, my. It's Anything Goes Friday. We're taking your calls at 866-303-2270. Our telephone number. Drop into our live chat room over at TomHartmann.com. Participate in our blog if you'd like there. Also at AirAmerica.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Worry about what they say. Let a little gossip coming from a loose lip will ruin my perfect day. Saying blah, 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 just a deck and their dog's got to let it roll up and on back. I don't give a darn what other people think. What do you think about that?
34 minutes past the hour. Well, what do other people think? This is actually the world's opinion. This is one of the issues that was raised in the debates last night. In fact, it was raised a number of times by the candidates, by both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, in response to questions at various times, was how bad our standing is in the world as a consequence of the belligerence and the bizarre testosterone driven, well, actually I'd say dry drunk driven, you know, the intellectual, emotional, and psychological dysfunctions of Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld and George W. Bush, and, you know, these people who by and large have been running the Republican Party in this administration. And again, I'll pick up your calls here in just a second, but I just, Dwight Eisenhower, we played several clips from two speeches of his earlier when we were talking with Bernie, and I just want to share with you his prayer for America that he closed his farewell address with in 1960 as he was leaving office and handing the keys over to John Kennedy. He gave a farewell address to the United States. It's the famous address where he warned us about the dangers of the rise of the military-industrial complex and said we can't afford to let this happen, and we can't, and warned about the possibility of deficit spending and becoming, you know, phantoms, putting our children and grandchildren, mortgaging the future of our children and grandchildren for today's material gains and things like that. And then he wraps it up with his prayer for America.
May we be ever unswerving in devotion to principle, confident but humble with power, diligent in pursuit of the nation's great goals. To all the peoples of the world, I once more give expression to America's prayerful and continuing aspiration. We pray that peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its spiritual blessings. Those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibility, that all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, and that the scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made disappear from the earth. And that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love.
Mutual respect and love. A Republican. 866-303-2270. Steve in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. First off, it's a pleasure to finally listen to you in real time, since I have XM during the day usually. I had two things. Well, the quick one, and the first one is, a good debate question would be to ask them which of the extra powers Bush has grabbed for himself that they would walk back in both the Democratic and Republican. But also something struck me when you played that Nixon quote about when the president does it, it's not illegal.
Right.
McCasey pretty much paraphrased that in his hearings, but they still passed him in deference to Schumer. I think the best thing they could have done would be to grab eight or nine of those fired U.S. attorneys and submit them as a list of who could get approved, since we already know they wouldn't, you know, that they wouldn't violate the law for Bush.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, that's a good idea. And I think Schumer really stepped in it.
That would have been a great political move, too.
Yeah, I agree. Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it. I think Schumer just stepped in it terribly, you know, pushing McCasey. But on the other hand, it's inconceivable, frankly, that George Bush is going to put somebody into power as attorney general who would then prosecute George Bush. And the minute the attorney general says, yes, we have committed crimes at the order of the president, there is no alternative. You have to either prosecute him or impeach him. And so, of course, Mukasey's not going to say it. Ted in Tigard, Oregon. Hey, Ted, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm calling on a kind of a different topic than you covered today, but...
hey, it's Anything Goes Friday.
I'm curious to know what the process is for organizations like Progressive Democrats of America for choosing which candidates to support and which ones not to. As, for instance, I see there's heavy promotion for Donna Edwards in Maryland when she beat the incumbent there, and I'm curious to know if there is any way that support like that can be leaned towards Mark Valesko in the 1st Congressional District here in Oregon in his campaign against David Wu.
PDA has run basically, you know, a poll, a voting, an online election, as it were, to see who's going to get the money and who's going to get the support of the organization. And there are other organizations that have done that as well. MoveOn.org did that with the presidential race and ended up endorsing, as a consequence of the majority of their members endorsing Barack Obama. So that's how you do it. And Progressive Democrats of America, you can Google it. I believe, actually, I'm not going to give the URL because I'm not sure that the one I have in my head is absolutely accurate. But okay. Yeah, that's how it was done. And that's, you know, when Nancy Skinner came on, that's what we were talking about, and others we've had on talking about that. So that's the way to do it. And go check out their website and have your candidate, if you have a candidate who wants their support, have your candidate get in touch with them. I'm not on the board of directors. I'm on the advisory board, so I can't tell you about how the inside stuff works because, I'm more lending my name to them and supportive of them than anything else. Brian in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, you often mention that free trade isn't free, and in light of that, and if you clarify that for me, please, I'd have a suggestion for one of the Democratic candidates.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was asking you. Your
why do I say free trade isn't free?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing free about it. Free trade is all of trade is regulated. Period. I mean, there's all kinds of regulations that have to do with trade, rules that have to do with what can be traded and what's safe and what's not safe and what's legal to import and what's illegal to import and all these kinds of things. And typically, most countries, for example, China just increased by 10% their tariff on the import into China of automobiles that have high technology in them. You know, if you want to import a simple car, fine, but if you want to import a fancy car, they want to develop their own fancy car industry in China. And so they're doing, China is doing what we're not doing. There's a whole bunch of countries around the world, the majority of them, Japan, Korea, South Korea, that have very, very restrictive import trade policies. But we don't. We just say, fine, you know, if you, you know, if an American company wants to go overseas and make something and then sell it back here, you know, that's fine. That's not free trade. That's not even fair trade. That's corporate outsourcing of labor. It's arbitrage of labor. We have more than 50% of all international trade is done within individual companies. In other words, an American company sets up closes down a factory in Detroit and opens the same identical factory in Shenzhen, China, and then ships their own products to themselves in the United States and sells it in the United States. More than 50% of all international trade takes that form. That's not trade either. That's the outsourcing of labor. That was my point.
Yeah, I do. I agree with that. But if I would like to see one of the either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama deal honestly with the Americans and say, look, if we could bring some jobs back with imposition of tariffs and that, but it's not going to happen overnight, that a company's not going to build a brand new plant or even open a mothballed one if they even exist. And not to mention, you know, just the infrastructure, the energy supplies that it would take to bring back some of our industry.
Look at how rapidly China has developed. I lived for the month of November 1986 in Beijing. And, you know, that wasn't that long ago. It was, what, 86, 96, 20 years ago, more or less, 22 years ago. And I stood in Tiananmen Square. You walk up, there's this main street, this big, you know, six lanes in both directions, giant street. And I stood there and every minute or two or 3 minutes, one car would go by, and the rest of it was just this ocean of black bicycles. There, you know, the city had a perpetual haze from small coal fires. There were no skyscrapers. The country was not industrialized. In the 20 years, and I wrote about that in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, how people when I was there said, the next century is going to be the Chinese century. You just watch. We're going to rise up and take over the world economically. And the industrialization of China, Beijing today is a completely different city. And that has happened just in 20 years and arguably in just in 15 years. And as a result of the changes in trade policy that were in large part put into place by the last Bush administration, the Clinton administration, and this current Bush administration, and if we simply change those trade policies, we could see the reindustrialization of the United States as well, frankly, in my opinion. So I don't think it's rocket science, and I think it can happen very quickly. But, Brian, your point is well made that you know, it's incremental step-by-step stuff, but frankly, I think an awful lot of this can move very, very fast. Let's see. Alex, and thanks for the call. Alex in Montana. Hey, Alex. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Good afternoon. Yeah. Number one, I'm a liberal Democrat from the Northwest. I appreciate your views on our difference in corporate and labor. But the thing that came to my attention was the low approval rating of Bush last night as it was presented. I guess he's in the lowest numbers that any president's ever been in.
He's down at 19%, I think.
Yeah, but then he's got a small percentage there that's still supporting him. I was wondering if you might be able to elaborate on that small percentage that's still supporting him.
You know, there are some people who will always root for their football team or their baseball team no matter what, even when the guy gets caught with steroids, even when it's a disaster, even when the team is losing. There are some people who view politics as sports, and they're just going to go with their guy no matter what.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
A special thanks so much to my producer, Sean Taylor, to Louise Hartman, to Chris Rosen, Lauren Kirshner, Marcus Hillman at Air America, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors who keep us going, and to you for listening to our program, supporting our sponsors, and supporting our local radio stations, letting them know that you're listening and that you like the show. Thank you. 9.5 minutes before the hour, 866-303-2270, our number, Fred in Michigan. Hey, Fred, what's on your mind today?
Well, good afternoon. I know one of the callers a few minutes ago mentioned that Barack had taught constitutional law in Chicago. In fact, he's been a professor at the University of Chicago, Chicago Law School, for the last 10 years. And as I'm sure you're aware, the University of Chicago is one of the finest institutions in the United States, if not the world. And
certainly their law school is, yeah.
Absolutely. So obviously he has a great understanding of the law.
Yeah, I have a lot of problems with their Department of Economics, but that's another topic.
Right.
Milton Friedman, you know.
Secondly, I was driving back from an appointment. I was absolutely chilled when I heard about the incident at the rally with the Secret Service apparently pulling off the local police from frisking and checking people's bags from coming into the rally for Barack Obama. My son-in-law is a member of the Diplomatic Security Service and traveled extensively with Secretary Rice on her security detail for an extended period of time. My daughter also traveled for about 3 years with the Secretary as a civil servant and in the Department of State, and obviously went to a lot of very dangerous places, were confronted with a lot of dangerous situations, and security was of the utmost importance. This young man is not only now in training to become a regional security officer at a foreign country that will be traveling to for 2 years in what is considered a danger zone, a danger country. I won't mention it because I don't want to embarrass him. But his father is also a retired member of the Secret Service who retired at the very highest ranks, at a very, very high rank of the Secret Service. And I find it absolutely incredible to believe that this is something that just happened, and it chills me to believe that this could happen. And in fact, I was in Washington. I live in Detroit. I was in Washington a couple weeks ago on a delayed Christmas visit with him, and I mentioned the fact that I was concerned about the safety for Senator Obama, how easy it would be for an assassin to sit several hundred yards away with a sniper rifle and shoot him. And his comment to me was that most political assassinations are committed by people with handguns. And we saw that as recently as the last couple of weeks in East Timor, where I believe the prime minister was shot at very close range. And it's just absolutely chilling to me. I'm scared to death for Barack, for Senator Obama. But to see something like this happen, I'll be very, very interested to see what reaction, if any, there is from the Secret Service, who is held responsible, and if there are any changes made, because I just cannot, for the life of me, knowing a little bit about what my daughter has gone through and reading a book now written by Glenn Kessler about the Secretary's travels over the last several years that included my daughter, I just find it incredulous that something like this just happened. Because these things just don't happen.
Fred, I share your concern, and thank you for putting an articulate voice to it. Let's keep in mind that the article that I shared with you by Jack Douglas Jr. of the Star-Telegram, the Dallas-Fort Worth Star-Telegram, said Dallas Deputy Police Chief T.W. Lawrence, head of the Police Department's Homeland Security and Special Operations Division, said the order, apparently made by the U.S. Secret Service, was meant to speed up the long lines outside in Philly Arena's vacant seats before Obama came on. And then the article also says the Secret Service did not return a call from the Star-Telegram seeking comment. So we don't know for a fact that this was the Secret Service's decision to stop doing the search. We just know that this article in the Dallas-Fort Worth Star-Telegram says that apparently that was the case, but that there is no doubt that they did stop the security, assuming that these news reports are accurate. So, yeah, I think it's got a lot of us very concerned. Kevin in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Kevin.
Hi. I was just calling to comment about the apparently the Albanian mafia and Albanian terrorists have duped the world. So it's basically on the Kosovo.
Mm-hmm.
My wife is a Macedonian. I've been to Macedonia. I was there at the time the Tetovo was taken over by the Albanians. It was totally unprovoked. I talked to people, ethnic, Slavic, Macedonians and also Albanians, from Tetovo. I heard no account of provocation from the Slavic Macedonians.
Yeah. Kevin, I get it. But this area is just an absolute, let's go back to it's almost like let's go back and re-debate the Turkish-Armenian, was it a genocide or not? I mean, the region has been just a mess for a long, long time. And yeah, you're right there.
My point is it's not just a mess. I think that's a mistake. If you look at ethnic Macedonian Slavic, they have a history of actually being much more inclusive, and especially during their membership of Yugoslavia. And I think the main point is most people in the West, including the Bush administration, even Colin Powell, thought Yugoslavia was a former Soviet state, so which is a total fallacy.
Well, they were sort of a satellite. I mean, they were aligned with, yeah. Kevin, I'm sorry we're out of time, but point made, and I appreciate it. Anything Goes Friday, wrapping up. Coming up on Monday's Tom Hartman program, I'll be debating the massive bee-free call with Paul Shapiro of the Humane Society and Lena Johansson of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. That should be entertaining. And the American Spectator's publisher, Al Regnery, is going to be here. He's the author of The Ascendance Upstream, The Ascendance of American Conservatism. Huh? Don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you Monday. Have a great weekend.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.